Well, good evening, everyone. Erev Tov. Welcome to Torah 2.0 here at SPL. This week in Torah 2.0, we are going to be looking at Parashat, or portion Lech Lecha. Lech Lecha covers Genesis chapter 12 through chapter 17. So that's the portion we'll be dwelling in. And tonight, a lot of what I'll be sharing with you, I've never shared before. Some of it because I never knew it before until I was with my teacher recently. And some of it just because I never thought it was the right time to share it. But for whatever reason, I feel now is the right time to do that. So it's a really powerful portion. All of those in Genesis really are, because as we talked about in Bereshit, we're really dealing with the seed level, not only in the opening portion, but kind of the opening book of the Torah. We're at this seed level where everything exists in potential. And so it's just, it's so, so dense. And so we'll even be looking at, for instance, in this portion, Abram, as he's called, he's not yet Abraham. Abram, you know, many people may know, well, the only difference between Abram and Abraham is the addition of, in English, the letter H, or adding the letter He in Hebrew. But through jots and tittles, we're actually going to see where that He came from. Where did the hay come from? And then once we locate where the hay came from and understand what that hay did when it was added to Abraham's name, we then have access to that hay for ourselves. And so that's just an amazing, amazing thing that we're going to be looking at this evening, as well as a lot of, I think, very personally enriching nuggets hidden within the text. Now, to remind you, one of the things we're going to be doing in Torah 2.0 is as we look at the text, we're going to be looking at it from that kind of archetype point of view. We briefly introduced that also in the first class in Torah 2.0. Archetype, the original pattern or model from which all things of the same kind are copied, or on which they are based. It's a model, a first form, a prototype. But more so, we'll be using archetype from kind of the Jungian model. That is a collectively inherited unconscious idea, a pattern of thought or an image and so forth that is universally present in individual psyches. And so what all of that really means is, it's not that Abram wasn't a real person. He was a real person, and the stories in the Torah about him are 100% true. They're 100% historical and so forth. But also, in addition to that, Abram, and then eventually Abraham, also is part of a collective consciousness that's in every single human being. And so the Torah, the reason why it's universally applicable, the reason why it works in all times and in all cultures for all people, is because it operates also on this level. It's not just a history book. It's more than that. And so it operates on this level, and it's addressing us and what who we are and what our makeup is. And so tonight we're going to be looking at how do we converse with, how do we interact with the Abram and eventually the Abraham that is within each one of us. And so it's this collective unconsciousness that's found in all of humanity, since from the origin we all flow from the same source. And so this ultimately, there are things that are in all of us, and the Torah is trying to reach those parts of us and tell us the best way to interact with them, bring them out, use them for good and not for evil, and so forth. And so we're going to be using the archetypal model again tonight, and probably quite a bit through Torah 2.0. It's similar to what we did in Torah 1.0 with looking at fractals and shadows, but it's also slightly more nuanced than that. And maybe in Torah 3.0 we'll get to the hologram level, where the Torah is really a hologram. But that will be in the future. Tonight we're going to stick with the archetype. So as we do that, let's begin by thinking about the state of Israel. Israel is also an archetype. It's not just a geographic location in the world, in the continent of Asia, and a place to locate on a map. Though it is that, it is also more than just a political state. The state of Israel is also a state of mind, and it's a state of spirituality. And much like we've talked about before with, Passover happens on the 14th day of the month of Nisan, most people think, well, the reason why that day is holy is because Passover happened on it. But we've learned to think the other way around. Rather, the reason Passover happened, it happened on the 14th of Nisan because of what the 14th of Nisan is and what is available on that day. Same as with the land of Israel. The land of Israel is not holy because David planted Jerusalem and a capital there. Rather, its inherent holiness drew David there, and that's why he wanted to plant a capital and build a temple there and so forth. It's the other way around of what we normally think about. But in addition to that, Israel also represents something much deeper within all of us. It's ultimately the promised land is a state of mind. It's a state of spirituality. And so as I said at the very beginning, the name of this week's portion is Lech Lecha. In Hebrew, those are two Hebrew words. In Hebrew, it can translate to you go out or you go. It implies a journey. But more specifically, Lech Lecha, if you look at it on your handout up at the top, you see that the two words in Hebrew look identical, right? It's because they are identical, all right? And so it literally means, though, lake is a verb coming from halach, which means to walk or to go, and lecha is not from that root. These are homonyms. They are spelt the same and they sound the same, but they are different words. And so it's not a go, where a seminary would tell you, oh, that's the Hebrew way of emphasizing this. No. It's go, and lecha, lamed is a preposition to, and ha, yourself. So it literally means go to yourself. And so a journey is being implied here. But Abram's journey is not just a physical journey. It is a spiritual journey. It's an internal journey. It is a journey to find himself, to find out who he is. Okay? And that's what we're going to have some fun with this evening. And so, Lech Lecha means to go to yourself. The journey being described, therefore, is a journey to our own being, to our own selves. The basic teaching behind this week's Torah story, it concerns transcendence, where we are helped to go out and escape the bonds of our ego, to break free of self-interest, and in the process emancipate ourselves from our illusionary comfort zones. True spirituality, true spiritual light, is only found outside of the box we've grown used to living in. Physical boxes, emotional boxes, and spiritual boxes. Once we become in a box, we have lost a lot of light, and we have lost a lot of connection. On the most literal level, on the Peshat level, Abram was told at the very beginning of Genesis 12 to go to this place that will eventually be known as Israel, but to go to the land of Canaan, to go to the promised land, to go to this land. But Israel is an archetype. That is, it's a code word that really symbolizes a higher level of spiritual existence. This is why Jacob, after he has his encounter with his divine being, whether you understand that to be an angel or wrestling with God himself, he gets renamed Israel. But yet, even though he's renamed Israel, he's not always called Israel. He is still sometimes referred to as Jacob. That is because Jacob, whenever he's referred to as Jacob, refers to him on a lower level, a lower spiritual connection. Israel is a more exalted level for him. It's when he is more connected to the ways of God, the will of God, seeing things God's way. It's one who has struggled with God and who has overcome. It's one, Israel doesn't just mean a God struggler, but it also means straight to God. In fact, that's the more literal meaning of Yasher El. Straight to God, nothing in the way, nothing impeding him. And so when he's called Israel, it's not just his name, it's describing his spiritual state. And so this higher level of spirituality that is known as Israel also corresponds to what is known as the Sefirah of Chesed. That is, when we look at this thing called the Tree of Life and these 10 chief attributes of God, one of them is Chesed. Unconditional grace, love, mercy, yes, with no borders or boundaries. It radiates the energy of mercy. In fact, this was Abram's destiny. He was destined to be the channel and the conduit for bringing mercy into this physical world and to sweeten the judgments meted out on account of negative actions. But to achieve this, Abram, who was not at this point yet named Abraham, had to leave his country, his birthplace, and his father's house. That's the opening verse of Genesis 12 for our portion. Basically, God says, go and leave everything you've got. Leave your country, leave your birthplace, leave your father's house. But all of those are also archetypes, are codes to help us understand Abram's lower state of consciousness, as well as ours. In effect, the journey God sent Abram on was a way for Abram to rid himself of the negative forces, are the what are known by the sages as klipot, the shell, the hardness, the crustiness that has kind of overtaken who we are as image bearers of God, that have attached themselves to us. That Abram's journey is to rid himself of all of this so that he could raise his consciousness, his divine consciousness, his messianic consciousness, and to be a more mature individual on a spiritual level. And so for order for Abram to have this type of journey, there's a physical journey involved. And this is a very important principle, methodology in biblical interpretation. Whenever someone goes on a trip or a journey or travels, it's not just about the physical trip. Again, yes, it's history, it really happened, he really traveled, but it's also indicating spiritual movement, when it can be ascending or descending. You can go up. That's why even if you're north of Jerusalem and you're on a mountain that is way higher on elevation than Jerusalem and you're north of Jerusalem, you still go up to Jerusalem. Because it's not just the physical trip you're taking to Jerusalem, but it's also a spiritual journey that's designed to elevate you. And so what's going to be necessary for Abram to become Abraham and to bring and become this vehicle of chesed into this world, to become this chariot of God? Well, it's going to require him to leave his country of origin. It's going to require him to leave his residence and everything that he knows familiar. It's going to require him to break free of his father's house and the controls that that his father has on him, both literally and figuratively. Once breaking out from all of that, then Abram is more ready to be developed spiritually. And this is something we should be able to relate to. It could be as simple as when you were 18 years old and maybe went to college and it was the first time you lived away from your parents. Well, that trip, that journey, wasn't just you moving 50 miles to Bloomington or 100 miles or 400 miles to Ann Arbor or something like that, though it was that. There was something else that caused within you. Or it could be another experience in life, a new job that required you to relocate, or even relocate within the company, but relocate to a different building in town, a different office, and with different people around you. It wasn't just a change in your geography, right? It changed some fundamental things about who you are and how you see the world. And that would not have happened had it not been for that journey. That's what's going on with Abram. But ultimately, we're going to see that's what goes on with us and is going on with us. And so how do we then, once we understand that, once we have that knowledge, how do we make the best use of that knowledge? And so as we read this week's portion in Genesis chapter 12 through chapter 17, what you need to keep in mind as you read those chapters is that each one of us ultimately has a similar mission and destiny as Abram did. There is an Abram inside of you. As such, we've all been ordered to set out, to go to ourselves, and also to go to the promised land, to go to Israel, which ultimately is a state of mind, a level of spirituality, a deeper connection to the light of our Creator. In archetypal terms, to journey to Israel means to move away from being reactive, to move away from being materialistic, to move away from being selfish, and instead move towards someone who is deeply proactive, who is spiritual, who shares, and who loves unconditionally. We spend so much of our time in reactive mode, always reacting to something, reacting to what he said or what she said, or reacting to what he did, or reacting to what we have heard through the grapevine. Reaction, reaction, reaction. This is all the land of Ur. This is all the land of Ur. We are being called to leave that behind and be more proactive with who we are. And so Abram is going on this journey. And this week's portion connects us to and charges the Abram that is within each one of us to do this. And as we are reading these pages, as we read chapters 12 through 17, what's going to be happening for you is, what's the little thing, the little musical thing that at the end shaped kind of like a Y and you bang it and it gives off a resonance? Is it pitchfork, tuning fork or whatever? Right, so what you're going to find in this week's portion is when you bang the little fork there, the spiritual reverberation is going to resonate. It's going to be in tune with the Abram that's inside of you. That's where it's going to hit you. It's not going to hit your Moses. It's not going to hit your David, right? It's not going to hit your Rachel or your Leah. It's going to hit your Abram. And that's as you, before you read the passages, before you read these chapters, that's what you need to be praying about. That's what you need to be asking to be open to. That's what you are seeking to have happen, is that these words and these pages will resonate with the Abram that is inside of you. It will stimulate the Abram that is within inside of you. But if you don't know that's what's being stimulated, even if the pages seem meaningful to you and you seem interested in it and you seem that you like it and it seems to be speaking to you, if you don't know what part it's speaking to you about, then a lot of times you're just kind of left with, there should have been more there. There should have, well, this is how you learn that there's more. You learn with what parts of your soul, in archetypal terms, this portion of the Torah is trying to speak to, trying to waken up, trying to stimulate and make come alive. And so it will be going to that. It will help you achieve spiritual growth in areas of being more gentle and merciful, as opposed to one who is filled with torment or anguish or agony. Going out of our country, going out of our birthplace, going out of the house of our father. Again, that's all in the first verse of this Torah reading. God says to leave all of these things. What that means, again, for us is to let go of our ego, our old ways of thinking, our comfort zones, right? Your country, your birthplace, your father's house. These are all ideas of safe places, or should be safe places, comfortable places, predictable places, places you know what happens, places you know what the food tastes like, you know when the supper is served, you know what the reactions are, you know what the favorite TV shows are, you know what they're going to say when this happens. It's your house that you grew up in, with your parents that you lived with, in the town, in the city, in the state that you've always lived in. It's a place of comfort. But in order for us to grow spiritually, in order for that Abram part of us to expand with chesed and love and mercy and compassion, it has to leave the box. It has to leave what is most known and comfortable and go to places yet unknown that will be shown to you, as God tells Abram. Go to a place that I'll show you, right? As you go, you'll figure it out, right? It's not about your destination. It's about the journey and what will happen to you on the journey. So he says, go. I'll show you where you're going. Just go. Get out of the box, because as long as you're here, you're not going to be ready to hear what I have to say to you. As long as you're here, you're not going to be ready to receive the teachings that I'm going to give to you. You're going to go back to old ways. You're going to fight against it. And so we're being called out of these ways of thinking and these comfort zones, these habitual patterns of behavior, so that we can then connect to the light that is ours through our Messiah, and so that we can find the spiritual fulfillment that God desires of us. The sacred words that tell this story, literally the very words as they are laid out on the page, are what help us remove these klipot, these shells, these blockages from our consciousness, so that we can attain the state of Israel, this place of chesed, the energy of mercy. The light flowing through these letters also softens our inflexibility in situations where stubbornness and ego prevent us from embracing spiritual change. Many times in our lives, as we seek to grow closer to God, to understand God better, to be in a closer relationship with God, to be more like our Messiah, that very often through that we find the temptation to be stubborn when it requires change, when it requires us to change responses, when it requires us to change behavior, when it requires us to change actions, when it requires us to change locations, when it requires us to change habits, then there's a part of us that's stubborn and resistant to that. This portion is designed, its spiritual technology is designed to break that down. That's why these pages are important. Not just because they tell us the history of a guy named Abram, who becomes Abraham, who becomes the father of the Jews, and therefore the father of the Christians, and so forth and so on, which all that's true, but that's not why these pages are actually important. They're important because of the spiritual technology that it affords each and every single one of us. The technology that was Abraham's is ours in these pages. Okay, so let's look into some of the text now that we've set it up. Lech Lecha and Abraham's 10 trials. According to Jewish tradition, as it's recorded in what's known as Pirkei Avot, or the sayings of the fathers, it's part of the Mishnah, God tested Abraham 10 times. Now, there's a lot of significance in why it's 10 and all of that, but so that we don't get into this whole, if the Bible doesn't say that, well, we're going to look at two of them that the Bible does say. That way we know at least two trials are biblical. They're all biblical, by the way. But we're going to look at two of them, the first and the last, that occur, trials in Abraham's life. And we're going to see how Lech Lecha is surrounding both of them. The very first trial, the very first test, was right here in Genesis 12, right? To leave his family, to leave his possessions. And here's what I really love. If you look at Genesis chapter 12, verse 5, what the Hebrew literally says is, all the souls that he had made in Haran. Different translations do different things with that. That's going to be very significant, because the reason Abram and Sarai had not had any children was because of where they were living. But they were making souls. But they were not making babies. But they were making souls. So just hang with that, because that's going to come back in what we talk about. That's in Genesis 12:5. So his first test is to, again, leave everything that's known to him. Leave everything that makes life comfortable. Leave everything that makes life familiar. And go into the unknown with only the souls that you made in Haran. And go. Go out, Lech Lecha, of the land and the place from your birth, and from your father's house to the land I will show you. Genesis 12, verse 1. Having passed that test, Abram would receive a trifold divine blessing, as the following verse makes clear. This is Genesis 12 and verse 2. Having gone out, I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. You shall be a blessing. And then there's Abraham's 10th and final trial. God commands Abraham to take his son Isaac and sacrifice him. But what's interesting is this last test of Abraham echoes the first test. What were the first words of Abraham's first test? Lech Lecha. Right? Well, when in Genesis 22, when God commands Abraham to do this, his first words are, guess what? Lech Lecha. Go out, go to yourself, to the land of Moriah, and bring your son as an offering on one of the mountains that I will show you. So again, we're involving a journey to oneself. So that in this process of traveling from where they're at to one of the mountains of Moriah, which is where the temple would stand and where the Mount of Olives is, both of those are part of the mountain range known as Moriah. On one of those, right, you are going to sacrifice your son. It's in this process, in this journey, that Abraham will move to a different level of connection to God. A close examination of the words Lech Lecha again reveal the double meaning. On the one hand, God's telling Abraham, go on this physical journey. But on the other, he's telling them to go to yourself. This idea again, Lech Lecha, means go to yourself. God, in his first direct communication with Abraham, seems to be implying that leaving one's land and one's father's house is more than just a simple change of location. This move implies breaking out of a lifetime of habits and norms, of overcoming physical and spiritual limitations that Abraham may have not even known that he had. That is, Abram at the time was probably completely unaware of much of what he needed to work on. Now, my kids laugh at me because I really love kung fu movies. I love kung fu movies. But I only like a certain kind of kung fu movie. And that is the kung fu movies that always involve a teacher and a student. And usually, Allah even like Star Wars, the way Luke was originally, the student who the master sees the great potential in the student. In fact, sees more potential in the student than the student could ever dream that he had. So one, the student isn't even aware of what he can become. But also, the student is completely unaware of what he even needs to work on in order to become what he can become. And so the whole relationship is about how does the master draw out all of that potential into actuality. How does he get the disciple to work on those aspects of his personality, his behavior, his skill set, his strength, his stamina, all of it, so that he can become what, at that point, only the Master knows that he has. And this is the same for Abram. Abram doesn't even realize all that God knows he's capable of, and what God is going to do in him and through him so that all nations are blessed, because it's through him he's been chosen to be the one that through him the seed of Messiah comes into this world. He has no idea of what that even means. And so part of that are these tests, these trials. Leave your land, take your son. And so the journey will prove to be a qualitative inner journey and a spiritual struggle. And from this, we may conclude that the aim of the trials of Abraham was not simply to prove Abraham's belief in God or that he trusted in God above all things, but more importantly, it was God's way of helping Abraham achieve a greater self-knowledge, a greater self-awareness of who he is, and to deepen his faith. It wasn't to prove his faith, it was to deepen his faith. There's an important principle that the sages speak of. It's quoted in many places. One of them is in the Talmud in Tractate Sota 34a. It says, the actions of our forefathers are as signs to their children. And specifically, it means the patriarchs, not just fathers in general, but it's referring to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and in many ways what we might call the spiritual heroes of our faith, that what they really are is that they are signs for us, that they are portents for us. And so the archetype going on here is that Abraham's trials, his tests, apply directly to each one of us as we journey through life, whether in a conscious way or a subconscious way or even a super conscious way. Each thought and action of the patriarchs and the matriarchs have paved the way for each one of us in every generation. Therefore, it's crucial for us to understand the import and the nature of their stories. Because again, they're not just history stories. They are our stories. And they are our journeys. While the Torah until this point has not mentioned it, it will soon become clear the central dilemma in Abraham and Sarah's lives was their inability to have children. Hasn't quite revealed that where we're at in the Torah, but we kind of already know the story, and it'll be revealed to us very soon. The mystical tradition teaches that on a spiritual level, their intimate marital unions created the souls of all future converts. That's again Genesis 12:5. Take with you the souls that you, plural, you too have made. However, according to the laws of nature, they were not destined to have children. And so, in essence, this was their greatest trial and their greatest struggle, was their infertility. How might this inner struggle apply to Abraham and Sarah's descendants? Bringing children into the world symbolizes bringing to fruition our deepest latent potential. In fact, one might even say that having children is a manifestation of Lech Lecha, going to yourself. This is alluded to by the fact that the gematria, the numerical value for the words Lech Lecha, equal 100. In Hebrew, every letter is a number. When you add up Lech Lecha, it equals 100. Abraham was 100 years old when Isaac was born. In a certain sense, only when Isaac was born did Abraham fulfill the command of Lech Lecha in both its physical and its spiritual level. Ultimately, Abraham and Sarah's constant struggle and desire to fulfill God's word, along with their inner search for faith and knowledge, allowed them to transcend the laws of nature and have a child. With God's grace, they were able to actualize the fruits of their spiritual and their physical labors. The ability to reach the deepest inner place of revelation is one of the secrets of the land of Israel. The ability to reach the deepest inner place of revelation is one of the secrets of the land of Israel, both in a spiritual sense, but in a real physical sense. For those of you who have been fortunate or blessed to have been to Israel, I have no doubt, without exception, every one of you would be glad to tell another that they are not the same human being after their trip to Israel as they were before their trip to Israel. I have yet to meet someone where that isn't the case. Now, sometimes, and unfortunately, if they've gone to Israel and their vessel is not ready for it, it's not always a positive experience or change, but it's a change. I've not yet met anyone that has not changed, that has not changed at all after having been to Israel. That's why. That's what it's about. The ability to reach this deeper inner place of revelation. It's only in the state of Israel that God brings about the fruition of his plan for Abraham and his descendants. And so it's only when we are able to reach Israel that we reach our ultimate purpose as well. And there I mean the archetype of Israel. By reflecting on the very first words God spoke to Abraham, we can discover the basis for God's relationship with every one of his people. God commanded Abraham to go to the land of Israel so that he and his descendants would receive blessing. Clearly, the commandment of Lech Lecha, to search deep within ourselves, that would actually be the Foster International Translation, the version of Genesis 12:1. It would be, search deep within yourselves. That's how it would open. It would not open with go or go to the land. It would open with search deep within yourself. This command was not merely given to Abraham alone. It was given to all of his descendants, his physical as well as those who are grafted in by faith through Messiah. And we are all constantly challenged to find God in the innermost recesses of our souls and simultaneously serve him in the everyday world by studying his word, by connecting through the mitzvot, and by performing acts of chesed. Indeed, Isaac, Abraham's son, understood this message as the verse says in Genesis 26, verse 12. Isaac sowed in that land, and he found in that year 100-fold, and God blessed him. Now that you know Lech Lecha equals 100, there you know Isaac just Lech Lechad. And that is why he received blessing. Because part of this portion in Genesis with Isaac is after Abraham's death. Isaac's blessed 100-fold. Again, the number symbolic of the Lech Lecha process that his father had undertaken. How does Isaac get this? What is he doing after Abraham's death? He's going and redigging the wells that Abraham had dug and that the Philistines, that is negativity, chaos, klipo, sin, that have clogged up and buried. After many attempts, Isaac finally succeeds in uncovering the wells. And sometimes he gives them the same name that his father gave them. Other times he renames them. But by his digging them and naming them, he realizes God has no grandchildren. That he is not special because he happens to be Abraham's son. That if he wants what Abraham had with God, he's got to do what Abraham did to have that relationship with God. And so digging the wells, again, is symbolic and metaphoric for digging deeper into his teachings, digging deeper into the ways of God, digging deeper, going below the surface and finding the water, the source of life, the words of God. And so Isaac's revelation of living waters hidden in the earth is an external physical manifestation of his attempt to carry on the tradition of Lech Lecha, which is why he has 100-fold blessing. Our inner search provides us with the strength to express our ultimate potential in this world, and our expression of this potential, again, through the Word of God, through the mitzvot, the connections. This enhances the revelation. In your Hebraic toolbox, the very first tool is known as pardes. which is an acronym for the four levels of scripture interpretation. And Pardes, again, is an acronym. Pardes is a Hebrew word that literally means orchard, or beautiful garden. But it is referring to the four-tiered system of biblical interpretation, which reveals how each word, every verse, every story, every commandment in the Torah can be simultaneously understood on different levels. So you have the Peshat, the literal, historical, grammatical meaning. You have the Remez, what's being hinted at, the allegorical. You have the Darash, which is the homiletical, the ethical, the moral, the sermon. And then you have the Sod, the deeper, the esoteric, the mystical understanding. And by systematically applying these four approaches to a biblical text, many important insights can be drawn out of the text that otherwise would lie dormant. And so, again, one of the things I wish to share with you is not, hey, this is what's true and you should believe it because I'm telling you it's true in the Bible. It's rather to share with you the methodology of how do I look at Scripture with first century Galilean Hebrew Jewish eyes. Because that's our Messiah. That's our Messiah's worldview. That's his apostles' worldview. It's how they learned Scripture. It's how they taught Scripture. It's what was commonplace for them. How do we do that? All right. And so rather than just always telling you what a verse means, I would rather show you some examples, some easier examples of how it's done, so that then you can begin to learn to do it yourself. And this again is more kung fu. This is more master student kind of stuff, right? I'm not here to tell you everything. I'm not here to give you all the answers. Many of you by now probably figured out when I ask him a question, he either talks about something that doesn't seem related to my question, or he doesn't answer my question by just giving me the answer. He instead tells me how I can find the answer, where I should go to get the answer, how I should begin the process to find the answer. It's because that's what's better for you. Because then you're independent and you learn to do it. So I want to show you how Pardes works, a real life example of how it works in a text. And then from that, what insights it actually gives to us that if we just read through it, we might have missed. So Rashi is an individual who's often best known for his insightful commentary on the Torah. Many of you may have a Kumash that I've recommended, and it has commentary at the bottom. It's written by an individual known as Rashi. Rashi typically talks on the Peshat level, that straightforward, more literal meaning of the text. But if you pay attention to what Rashi does, you will see that many times he actually isn't doing that. He's actually relying on the Midrash, or allegorical or homiletical tools to decipher the text. In addition, he many times, while explaining the Peshat of a text, shares with you what also is being hinted at or alluded to, which is what the word remez means in Hebrew. Remez just means hint in Hebrew. And therefore, it's more accurate to say Rashi's explanation of the text draw from all four levels of learning. But he primarily focuses on explaining in depth the Peshat. But he really concludes all four. And so usually Rashi will give one example for each point he chooses to elucidate. But on occasion, he gives a beautiful way of seeing how all four of these work together. And so one of those verses he does this with is Genesis 15, verse 5. Genesis 15, verse 5, it says, "And he took him," meaning Abraham, "he took him outside." We're going to eventually focus on why outside. because it kind of didn't need to be stated. And why did he have to take him outside and to do this? And then you say, well, it's to see the scars. Well, then isn't it implied that he went outside? So we're gonna come back to outside. That's why it's underlined. But and God takes Abraham outside of his tent. Abraham's in this tent. God takes him outside of the tent and says, look now towards the heaven and count the stars if you're able to count them. And he said to him, so will be your offspring. This verse is describing God's reaction to Abraham's complaint that because he had no children, he would have no one to inherit him. So Abraham is complaining to God that he has no children. And this is why Abraham is inside of his tent. So God takes him outside of the tent and tells him to look up at the stars. Now Rashi's first explanation is on the Peshat. God quite literally took Abraham outside of the tent where they were talking with one another in order to show him the stars. That makes sense, right? If I wanted to show you the stars right now, I'd have to take you outside, right? That's a Peshat understanding of the text. Unfortunately, that's where most Christians in the church stops with the text. Well, they were inside. He wanted to show them something outside. So he took them outside to do that, right? So Rashi explains, hey, that makes sense. It fits with the storyline. God's asking Abraham to go outside so he can show the stars, dramatizing his point that Abraham would have many descendants and that God chose kind of like an experiential teaching method, which is highly effective in educational context to make its point. So it's just a nice dramatic effect. Come with me, let me show you something. But then Rashi continues and he says something that's based on the Midrash and it's comprised of two parts. The first part is a remiss, something that's being hinted at, alluded to in the text. Rashi decides, what if I do not take the words, he took him outside literally, but if I understand that to be figurative? And we use figurative language all the time, right? I'm going to give you a good kick in the pants. How many of you literally think that means I'm going to kick you in the pants? Some may, but most would understand, you know, that's an expression. I'm frustrated. I would like to kick you in the pants. I would like to do that, but I'm not. Or I'm going to school you, right? I'm not really going to take you to school and give you lessons on how to shoot basketball and so forth. When I say I'm going to school you on the court, you know, I'm implying something else. We use figurative language all of the time, right? And you can think of your own examples of figurative language. It's everywhere. And guess what? English isn't unique to that. Figurative language is used in every language all of the time. And so Rashi says, what if this is figurative language that's hinting, remiz, at something else for us to know? God instructing Abraham to go outside may be God instructing Abraham to leave behind preconceived notions, to go outside of his normal framework, and even in his day, to go outside of his own astrological predictions that he was not destined to have any children. God, by literally taking Abraham outside of the tent, hints that he needs to think outside of the box, if it were. That he must evaluate and reevaluate his true potential and not be stymied by the stars and their forecast. Because according to the Talmud and the oral tradition, Abraham, before he becomes a convert, if you will, and a follower of the one true God, he was an accomplished astrologer for his time. That he read the stars and knew the stars and so forth, and that he had read that he was not destined to have children. And so by taking him outside, God is saying, I need you to think outside the box. I need you to think even outside of the stars and all of the things that you think are governing your life and all of the things that you think make what you're going to be doing impossible or what I'm saying is impossible, all the reasons why you're going to fail, all the reasons why this isn't going to be the case, all the negative self-talk you have, I need you to rise above all of that. Right? Rashi then continues in this line of thought on an even more subtle Darash level, by explaining that God told Abraham that indeed Abram and Sarah, or Abram and Sarai at that time, their names had not been changed at this point in the narrative, that they could not have children. But while Abram and Sarai could not have children, Abraham and Sarah could. By changing their names to Abraham and Sarah, God was changing what is known as their mazel. You ever heard the phrase mazel tov? Right? He was changing their mazel. And those physical or spiritual factors that had prevented them from having children would now be overcome by the addition of the letter He to their names. Because how did God create the universe? He spoke. He used letters. The letters are creative instruments. He is one of those letters. We're going to soon see where Abraham gets his hay from. We won't talk about Sarah's hay just yet. We'll get to Sarah's hay eventually. Where Sarah gets her hay from. Abram and Sarah can't have children. But Abraham and Sarah can. But why did God have to take Abraham outside to tell him about the name change? And how would this alter his destiny? Was this merely just to dramatize his point? Or something else going on? When someone's name is changed in the Torah, it always indicates that he or she has undergone a qualitative transformation that is so great that a new name must be given to designate the new human being that he or she has become. Their fate has changed, their destiny has changed, their being has changed. Everything about them is so transformed that only a new name will do justice to the new human being. And yet, this transformation, while a gift from God, is not merely a gift from God. It also comes from within the person. And God alludes to this when he tells Abraham to step outside the tent. Again, meaning step outside the current self-definition and preconceived notions you have about you're 100 years old and you're never going to have a kid. Step outside of that. Step beyond that. And then he informs them that this process has the power to even alter what seems to be an unchangeable destiny. But not content with just a pashat, a remez, and a darash of the verse, Rashi offers a deeper level of understanding on the sod level. At this level, Rashi suggests that God did take Abraham outside, but that he took him outside of the earth's atmosphere and lifted him above the stars where he could look down on the situation, what we would call a Goodyear blimp view of the football field. Because the Hebrew can actually be read that way, that he took him outside, meaning he took him out of the bounds. He took him beyond the borders. And so Rashi says, what if we really... Because often the sod level isn't that it's so deep and mystical, it's often super hyper literal. So Rashi says, what if we take that word that really means to go above and beyond everything, to mean God, whether it was a vision or however, took Abram outside of everything, outside of space and time, so that he could see the whole divine plan from beginning to end. And so that he could understand everything, how Messiah would flow from him, and so forth. Which, by the way, this is the understanding Yeshua has of this, because in the Gospel of John, Yeshua says something very interesting. He says, when Abraham saw my day, he was pleased. How did Abraham see his day? Because Yeshua knew this oral teaching that God took Abram outside and showed him everything from start to finish, including all of the descendants that would flow from him. That he said, look to the heavens and count the stars. These are your offspring. And that Abraham was literally able to see every single human being that was his offspring for all time, which includes the Messiah. And so Yeshua says, Abraham saw me and was pleased, was happy, right? So there you have the tradition finding its way into your Gospels. And like I always say, what happens when these stories are in your divinely inspired New Testament? What does that mean about these stories? That they're true, right? And so Rashi says he took him outside of everything. He granted Abraham a more objective, divine perspective on the situation. And from this lofty viewpoint, Abraham could come to understand that God had a specific plan for his own life, and it did include having not only a son, but having offspring. Notably, even this sowed interpretation still, though, contributes to the literal reading of the verse, because it provides the explanation for the following question. If all God wanted was for Abraham to step outside of the tent, why not just ask him to? Why does the text have to say God literally, physically took him? The sowed interpretation explains that God would have only asked Abraham and taken him outside if outside was further than at first we might suspect. So Rashi's paying very close attention to the grammar, the vocabulary, and what's awkward in the structure of it. Rashi's comments therefore give us deep insight into not only this particular verse with its levels of meaning, but it gives us the tools and the ability to use Hebraic eyes to approach all biblical texts. We see that various levels of interpretation are ultimately all connected. They all play off one another in a very dynamic and yet subtle manner. The meaning of the word Hebrew, and a jot and a tittle. In this week's portion, we have the very first occurrence of the word Hebrew in the entire Bible. So in your Hebraic toolbox, one of your tools is the law of firsts. So I think we would all agree Hebrew is kind of an important word, right? The Hebrew people, I mean, all of that. Like, Hebrew is a pretty big word. And so here is its very first occurrence in Scripture. Genesis 14, verse 13, it says, Abraham the Hebrew. Now keep in mind, there are no Hebrew people at this point. There are no people known as the Hebrews yet, right? Because this comes after Abraham. And the reason they're called Hebrews is because of this verse that calls Abraham the Hebrew. So Hebrew originally has nothing to do with an ethnicity or a DNA code or a genetic test or where you were born or who your parents are or is your mama's a Hebrew. It has nothing to do with any of that because they're not a people yet. And they had not existed. No one's ever been called a Hebrew to this point. There is no Hebrew. There's no land of Israel yet. So how is Abraham a Hebrew? What does that mean? So what does the word Hebrew mean in Hebrew? All right, that's what we're going to look at. The root of the word for Hebrew in Hebrew is Ivri. It literally means Hebrew, or Ivrit. You take the feminine form. It means Hebrew. You want to learn to speak Hebrew? Medaber Ivrit. Do you speak Hebrew? Right? It means Hebrew. But before it meant Hebrew, as far as Medaber Ivrit, do you speak Hebrew? Are you a Hebrew? It meant to cross over. It was a geographic description. It was a verb that meant to cross over something. If you were standing on this side of the river and you walked through it and came out on that, you read it. You crossed over the river. That's its most original, authentic meaning. So the FIV would not have it as Abraham the Hebrew, but as Abraham, known as the one who crossed over. That's literally what it's saying. Abraham, the one who crossed over. Okay, so we're going to unpack that and see what's going on here. Why does the Torah give Abraham this name of Hebrew? One opinion is that he gained this name because in coming to Israel, coming to the Promised Land, coming to Canaan, he left his birthplace in Ur Chasdim, and he crossed over the Euphrates, a major geographical demarcation line in the ancient world of his time. And thus, when he got to the destination and he became this very rich nomad with all of his property and his own personal army and all of these things that could defeat whole kingdoms, he was known as the one who crossed over, right? Where is this guy from? We haven't seen him. He's the one that crossed over from the Euphrates. And so, it's from the Kung Fu kind of thing. One of the cool guys is Hundred Eyes. Why is he called Hundred Eyes? Well, it goes back to a story about, you know, he was blinded, but yet it's as if he has 100 eyes because he can sense all these other things now. Or Dances with Wolves. Why is he called Dances with Wolves? Because he dances with wolves, right? Okay, he's the one that dances with wolves, you know? That's his name. It describes who he is. So that would be a Peshad understanding of why he becomes known as the Hebrew. Because he's now in a different part of the world where he's clearly an outsider. He's a foreigner. He's not one of them. And so maybe that's how they identified him. He's the one that crossed over the Euphrates. But if we remember, physical journeys in the Torah are not just physical journeys, but they're always connected to a spiritual journey. Crossing over would hint to something deeper going on. In a more spiritual sense, the Midrash describes the entire world standing on one side, while Abraham crossed the boundaries of accepted thought of his day by choosing to believe in one God and one God alone. This is in the Midrash Rabbah Bereshit 42, section 13. And again, I've told that story about Abraham. His father was an idol maker. And Abraham begins to have these deep thoughts and so forth, and kind of sees the frivolity of idol making and idols. And he plays that trick on his dad where he destroys the idol making factory. His dad said, "Who did that?" And he's like, "It's that one idol over there who's standing." And his dad's like, "You're crazy. That's not what happened." Abraham does it again. What happened? It's that idol over there. He's the one that keeps destroying all these other idols because he doesn't like them. And his dad finally says, "These are just pieces of wood and stone that I carve. They don't have any power." To which Abraham says, "Exactly. So why are we making them? Why are we selling them? Why are we promoting them? Why are we keeping people in ignorance? There is one God." And that becomes his mission, is to be this chariot of bringing this chesed, this loving kindness, and this relationship to this one God to the world. And so here is Abraham on one side of the world. He's crossed over to a completely different way of seeing spirituality, God, and all of that. And the whole other world is on the other side. He's undeterred by the physical hardship, the emotional difficulty of standing alone. Abraham was unafraid of crossing both the physical and the spiritual borders on his journey that God called him to go on. As we've already talked about, God took this one step further by urging Abraham to go outside, leaving behind the strictures of the natural world altogether. The letters in Abraham's name even allude to his standing alone, as only one letter, the letter Aleph, distinguishes the root of Abraham's Hebrew name, Avram, from the root Ivri, which uses a letter Ayin instead of an Aleph. Both letters sound similar, and in fact, they are often exchanged to reveal deeper hidden meanings of a word. In this case, the numerical values of the letters tell the story. The letter Aleph in Avram represents and equals one. It's the first letter of the alphabet. Ayin equals the number 70. 70 is the archetype for the nations of the world. That comes from 70 being the number of offspring from Noah's sons who repopulated the world after the flood. And so 70 represents the world's 70 archetypal nations. This numerical code is key to understanding the deeper meaning of the Midrash that says, Abraham crossed over and stood alone because of his belief in the one true God, represented by the Aleph in his name, while all the other nations stood on the other. And so he crossed over. The Aleph gets replaced with the Ayin, and Avram becomes Ivri. A cynic or a critic might argue that Abraham's decision to cross over and to leave the rest of the world on the other side indicates he had a disregard for the rest of the world. But that's not the case. When Abraham was commanded by God to leave his land, his birthplace, his father's house, and come to Israel, he is promised by God in Genesis 12 and verse 4 that in you all families of the earth will be blessed. God's promise that Abraham's separateness will actually be a source of blessing for the entire world. So Abraham sees this as only temporary, being alone, and that his decision will actually bring much blessing to everyone. Abraham crossed over to the other side in his firm belief that eventually everyone would join him in believing in this one true God. The current separation was temporary. The embrace of monotheism by much of the world, the rejection of idol worship, has proven Abraham's assessment largely correct. The notion of crossing over becomes a recurrent metaphor throughout the spiritual career of Abraham and his descendants. This is something you need to pay attention to in the vocabulary. It describes the physical act of crossing over, Ivri, Hebrew, and several messages throughout. When Abraham enters the land of Israel, the Torah says in Genesis 12:6, Abraham crossed into the land of Canaan. Here, by using the verb to cross, it is alluding to this additional level of holiness in the land of Israel. Just as crossing the Euphrates symbolized a major transition of forging a new path in his life, crossing into the land of Israel also indicates a new level of reality. In Genesis 15, when God makes a covenant with Abraham to give him and his children the land of Israel as an internal inheritance, Abraham falls into a deep sleep, and he experiences in a vision or a dream a torch of fire passing through two rows of animal carcasses. That's in Genesis 15, verses 1 through 25. In Hebrew, you don't make a covenant, you cut a covenant. That's the technical word. You cut a covenant. You literally cut an animal in half, put two parts of the carcass, the blood's in the middle. You and your person that you're making the covenant, the contract with, part through it, saying, if you break the covenant, you're going to end up like this animal. And so Abraham cuts a covenant with God, except Abraham falls asleep and he doesn't walk through it, which is a powerful statement about the nature of this covenant. God walks through it alone. But Abraham has this vision. And once again, the word cross is used to describe Abraham entering into a new relationship, a covenant with God. Even later in the book of Exodus, when the Israelites cross the Sea of Reeds, the Red Sea, in order to escape the pursuing Egyptians, they are leaving behind them slavery. Not just a literal physical slavery, but an entire slavery of the mental system, their spiritual system, everything that we... you listen to Torah 1.0 archives on the whole idea of the Exodus in bondage. When they crossed over the Red Sea, they crossed over into something different. The various uses of the word to cross over, whether they be to the command of Abraham to leave his old life behind him, or the request that he go beyond and outside of his preconceived understandings, are all consistent with a certain message God wishes to give to Abraham. Through his trials, Abraham is being taught that he must cross over, that he must cross over certain emotional, psychological, and spiritual limitations and stretch himself in every manner possible in order to grow. And that is so important for us to hear, because we live in a culture that does anything and everything possible to avoid discomfort of any level, including like the type of seat you have in your car. Like, we don't want any discomfort at all. We don't want anything to change at all, except what we want to change. So we protect, we create this whole bubble. We create bubbles around our kids. We create bubbles around our families. We create bubbles around our churches. We create bubbles everywhere. But God is saying, unless you're going to cross over, unless you're willing to leave it all behind and cross over emotional issues, psychological issues, what you think are limitations, unless you're ready to stretch yourself, you cannot reach the status of Lake Lecha. This insight into the nature of Abraham's tests offers us a perspective on a verse in the Torah, in the very first portion, Bereshit, that I think it's worth looking at. Genesis chapter 2, verse 4. These are the generations of the heaven and earth when they were created, in the day that the Lord God made earth and heaven. You're good Hebraic thinkers. You live in the Galilee. You've hung out with your rabbi on its shores for 3.5 years. What's the first thing you notice about that verse? The generations of heaven and earth and the day that God made earth and heaven. That's got to stick out to you, folks. The order has been reversed. And that's no accident, and it's no coinkydink. It's intentional. Because heaven and earth represent above and below, higher and lower, positive and negative, right? The polarity, all of those kinds of things. But when you look at the Hebrew of this verse, the word that is getting translated, when they were created. These are the generations of heaven and earth when they were created. So we're now in creation, right? We're in Genesis 2. We're in the whole formula of creation. That word, they were created, is one word in Hebrew. It's Beha Baram. Beha Baram. This is the same letters that make up the word Be'Abraham. In or through Abraham. So, these are the generations of heaven and earth for the sake of Abraham. It's actually how you can translate that. What's Abraham doing in this creation account? The implication being that heaven and earth were created for the sake of Abraham. And more specifically, not the dude Abraham, but in and through the aspect of Abraham. Chesed and mercy. Right? That's what he is. He represents the chariot of Chesed. So, more so, heaven and earth were made through mercy. They were made through mercy. Because in Genesis 1, they were made only with judgment. That's why Genesis 2 had to happen. Had to put some mercy in there. All of this is making good sense. Abraham is not only deemed the aspect of Chesed, the archetype of loving kindness, he's the chariot through which it enters this world. In other words, Abraham represents an archetypal energy, and his actions in this world channel the divine blessings of love. Being a chariot means, whether it's consciously or unconsciously, God's agent of creative energy through which the world is constantly being recreated. But here's what's really great. In a traditional Torah scroll, the letter He in Beha Baram is written especially small. So I'll put it on. This is a screenshot of my Torah that I use at my desk. So this is not a scroll, this is just a Torah. That's why it's got all the cool pointings and all that stuff. But I have it in a box here for you. So you see that letter there? You can see it's smaller, right? It's clearly a much smaller letter. That's the letter He. It's written small in this letter here. So that's a normal sized He right above it. See how it's the same letter, but it's small, half size. Why? We're in creation. This is where God gets the letter He to add to Abram's name. This is where he gets it. Right here in this portion of Genesis. And this part of creation. When this part of creation was going on and whatever it was before time and space are really clicking as we know it. This letter He, not another letter He, not that letter He, not that letter He. This letter He, in this word, when this word was spoken, these are the blueprints of creation. This is the letter He added to Abram's name. Why would this specific letter have been added to Abram's name? The small letter He, the one that will eventually appear in the name Abraham when the name is changed from Abram to Abraham. God had to get the He from somewhere. This is where he gets it from. This small letter He represents the divine spark with which Abraham's nature was imbued when his name change occurred, telling us that our goal in life is to shrink our ego, to transform ourselves from selfish, reactive individuals into people who desire to receive for the sake of sharing. This is important for you, and I put it on your handout because I want you to see it. I want you to visually see it. When we read this portion, these chapters, chapters 12 through 17, we need to flip back to Genesis 2:4. Because the energy that transformed Abraham is right there. When we begin reading about Abram and eventually Abraham in Lake Lecha, what transforms him from being infertile to fertile, from being in Ur to being in the state of Israel, what enables him to become an idol maker to a chariot of God's mercy, is that He. What that means for us is when we read Genesis 12 through 17, we should have that above the page. Because what that letter is doing, it's still a creative force. It's still the ingredients of creation. It's like if you make cookies, right, and one of the ingredients is sugar, what happens when I say, and you, the cookies are all eaten up, but the next day I say, here's some sugar from the sugar we made the cookies with last night. Do you say, no, it can't be. You've already made the cookies. The source of the sugar can't exist anymore. Ingredients of the creation of those cookies can't exist anymore. Or could you then take that sugar, taste its sweetness, and then put it to use somewhere else? Either make more cookies, or make pound cake, or do whatever else with it. Make caramel. Because you still have the ingredients. God used language, specifically the Hebrew language, to create heaven and earth. And so when we look at this, and we read Genesis 12 through 17, and we know this is about going out of my box, this is about stretching myself, this is about being willing to let go of things that I value, to let go of what I think things are, or what is limiting me, or what can't be done. I'm going to put all of that aside, and it's all resonating with my Abram, and I'm going to become Abraham. That's why you want to see this verse. That's why you want to see that little A, that little He. You need to contemplate when you stare at that. Everything we talked about tonight. Everything we talked about tonight is right there and that little letter He. And so this He becomes an agent of creation in you. And you become a little more like Abraham. You get to add a He to your name, to your Abram, so that it can transform. I tell you the truth, not one jot or tittle will pass away from the Torah. That's a jot. Our Messiah says it matters. All right, we will close there this evening. I told you it was going to be a fun class. Isn't that fun? This is good stuff. Oh, my goodness. If you only knew what I left off. All right. Good stuff, though. Good stuff. Let's close with a blessing. Baruch atah Adonai noten haTorah. Blessed are you, Lord God, who has given to us the gift of the Torah. Amen.